Hi there. A quick message before we start. Don't forget that you can save money this winter when you book your ski hire at intersportrent.com and use the code SKIPODCAST. You'll get a guaranteed discount for all ski hire in France, Austria, and Switzerland. And to make it even simpler, you don't even need to use that code. Just take the link in the show notes and your basket will automatically be reduced. So, if you want to support the Ski Podcast, remember to book your ski hire with Intersport and to use the code SKIPODCAST or take the link in the show notes. It'll save you money and help us too. Right, let's get on with the show. Welcome to episode 181 of the Ski Podcast, and thanks for joining us, listener. Today's episode is a special interview with Peter Landsman. Peter is the founder of the website liftblog.com and has personally seen more than 3,000 lifts in 720 resorts across North America. I'm pretty certain that no one out there knows more about lifts than Peter. Peter joined us from his home in Jackson Hole, and we cover a wide range of topics, including how his love for lifts started, his views on T-bars versus button lifts, what he thought of skiing in Europe, and we quiz him on his favourite lifts. I thoroughly enjoyed chatting with Peter. I think you'll enjoy our conversation, even the part where we are interrupted by a moose. My name is Ian Martin. I'd like to introduce my guest for this episode, Peter Landsman. Hi, Peter. How are you?
Good morning, Ian. Thank you for having me.
Well, you say good morning. For me, it's about 1:30 in the afternoon. What time of the day is it for you?
It is 6:30 a.m. here in the Rocky Mountains.
You're in the Rocky Mountains, and remind us which resort you're based in.
I am in Jackson Hole, Wyoming, which I'm guessing some of your listeners have probably heard of.
They absolutely have, I'm sure. It's on the bucket list for many, many people. I think Corbett's Couloir is in Jackson, isn't it? Is that right?
That is at the top of the mountain, yes.
Yeah, that's probably one of the most famous areas. But certainly, we had a few journalists from the UK go out to that area this winter. Rob Stewart has been on the show a few times, certainly wrote an article about it. And it's a very beautiful part of the world. I was lucky enough to be in Yellowstone last year, summer rather than winter. But as I say, it remains on my bucket list. Now, it's a real pleasure to have you on the show. And we've been trying to line this up for a while. You mentioned that season's sort of finished. I think I contacted you back in the autumn. And, you know, it's 6:30 in the morning. Normally in the life of a ski resort, that's the kind of starting point of the day. And you work it in Jackson Hole. But the reason I wanted to have you on the show is because I doubt there's anyone in America, possibly the world, who is so knowledgeable about every ski lift that's out there, particularly in the USA. And listen, if you don't believe me, I'm going to be talking about it, but you can have a look at Peter's site. I'll put a link into the show notes. It's called liftblog.com. Now, just give us some numbers, Peter. How many lifts in America have you seen in how many resorts?
I am up to just over 3,000 individual lifts at 720 ski areas, which is just about all of them. There are a few limited exceptions, like the private ski resort that I haven't been to. Are there a couple that are like at military bases? But other than that, I have been to every ski resort in America.
That is quite incredible. I mean, I've talked to some very experienced ski journalists, people like Arnie Wilson, who skied the world, Peter Hardy, and they've been to lots of ski resorts, but that is an unbelievable number. And I think it's gone up quite a lot. You must have been to quite a few this winter as well, I think, because you were below nowhere near 3,000 lifts like a year or so ago.
It has. I've been working on going to all the ski resorts in Canada this last year. So there are about 250 total in Canada, and I've been trying to get to as many of those as I can.
Right. That is a pretty amazing total. And we're going to come back to that and your knowledge of the lifts and your website as well. But evidently, you have real love for lifts and for skiing. You know, you're working in the industry. I wondered how you got into that. Where are you from in the States? Were you born in a ski resort?
I was not. I'm from Seattle, Washington. But I did grow up skiing from a very young age. My dad took me skiing starting at, I think, around 3 or 4 at Snoqualmie Pass, which is only about 45 minutes from downtown Seattle, which is a really amazing thing to have when you're growing up. And so we would go skiing every weekend at Snoqualmie Pass. And then later when I was in middle school and high school, we would go to Crystal Mountain, which is a really fabulous place right next to Mount Rainier that gets just a ton of snow and has great terrain.
Yeah, and doesn't, you know, that northwest part of the States has a really good snow record, right?
Absolutely. I mean, people who travel the world to ski, you know, don't necessarily think of the Pacific Northwest as a destination. It's not, these aren't glitzy resorts with big hotels and, you know, fancy restaurants, but the skiing itself is really great in that part of the world. It snows a lot. And I really enjoyed growing up there.
Yeah. And Mount Baker, is that over that way? Doesn't that hold all the records for kind of season snowfall?
Absolutely. World record snowfall is Mount Baker, Washington, which I believe is over 1,100 inches in one season. And that was in, I think, 97, 98, when I was 8 years old that season.
Wow. Okay. You obviously started skiing at a young age, and you might be interested in that. I also started skiing. My parents are skiers. You know, they took me, you know, at a young age, and, you know, I'm incredibly lucky in that respect, slightly more difficult from the UK because we're not 45 minutes or like a short drive away from a ski resort, but still managed to do it. And now I'm working in industry many years later. You're working in industry now. How did that segue into finding a job within skiing and snow sports?
Well, I took a pretty traditional American path. Went to high school at home, and then I went to college in New England, in Maine. So during college, I skied quite a bit, as much as I could. If you know, while some people were partying on Friday and Saturdays, I was trying to rest as much as I could to go skiing the next day. And I would drag whoever I could to go with me on Saturday mornings and Sunday mornings in college. And then after college, I knew I wanted to at least work at a ski resort for a season. And so back when I started, it was really you had to show up at a ski resort to get a job there. It was before Zoom and virtual hiring. So I actually went to a job fair in October in Jackson Hole in 2012 and just interviewed on the spot. A few days later, they called me, offered me a position as a lift operator, and I moved here that fall.
Why did you pick Jackson Hole? Because you come from the West Coast.
Yeah.
Educated over there on the East Coast. Did you think, right, I'll just pick somewhere right in the middle?
Well, I had been to Jackson Hole actually in the summertime, like most people, to go to the national parks. So I knew how beautiful it was. I wanted to be in a real ski town. There are a lot of ski resorts in America that are not actual towns that were built as ski resorts. Jackson is one of those cool places that was a town before it was a ski resort. So there's a lot of culture here, a lot of history here, and it's just a beautiful place. And I just kind of picked it on with a small amount of research and mostly just a whim.
Well, certainly from my knowledge of it, it is one of those special places. And you can tell me, I'm not 100% sure about the history. Was it a mining town before it was a ski town?
It was not mining. It was more fur trapping, kind of a trading post. And it was actually incorporated very late. I mean, I think the town of Jackson was not incorporated until like 1950. So there wasn't a whole lot here until fairly recently.
Yeah, so you get that, you know, that Wild West, as you might say, feel to it. And then you got your first job, you know, working as a liftie. Now you're a lift supervisor for the resort, is that right?
That's correct, yep.
What lift are you working on? Or are you kind of covering the whole system?
I have a few colleagues and we bounce around all the different lifts here. We have about 15 lifts, but I wear a bunch of different hats. In the off seasons, like right now when we're not open, I'm doing a lot of our hiring for the next season. I do a lot of our training. So when we have new employees, they need to learn how to run lifts safely. And then when we're operating, supervising a lift is wearing a lot of hats. But one of the ones is skiing around and checking in with everyone and making sure they're all where they're supposed to be, doing what they're supposed to be doing. So that means a lot of time skiing around the mountain, checking in at all the lifts.
Yeah, you make it sound like a really tough job.
It's tough. Somebody's got to do it.
Yeah, and so therefore, you know, you said when we were talking about a time to have a chat that, you know, early in the morning, 6:30 for you isn't a problem. During the winter, what's your kind of daily schedule then?
So in the winter time, you know, it's now 6:45. I would already be on the mountain by now. So we get there very early. A lot of times in the morning, I go up on a snowmobile to help get lifts ready before the lift operators even get there. Our gondolas here, we actually put all the gondola cabins inside at night. So often I help put the gondola cabins outside in the morning. And then we see who all shows up, which lift operators are maybe missing that day, and where they're all going to go, right, and how we're going to get each lift staffed and ready to go and free of snow by 9 a.m.
Yeah. And do you adjust based on, you know, how many guests you're expecting on the mountain that day? You must have some kind of feel based on seasonality and maybe on pre-lift pass sales, what the volume is going to be on a particular day.
We do. We have Icon Pass reservations, so we know how many Icon Pass holders are planning to come each day, and we know how many lift tickets have been sold in advance. But really, with lift operations, it doesn't so much matter how many skiers there are. We run all the lifts every day, as is our goal. So whether they're empty chairs going up or a big line, it doesn't change the job that much. We run the lifts regardless of the weather and regardless of the crowds.
Sure, of course, that makes sense. I guess maybe I was thinking about some of the measures that they've introduced in Europe in more recent years would be, if it's times of low demand, then they've been looking at maybe running the lift slightly slower, so it's imperceptible, you know, to the consumer, to the skier themselves, but it's an energy saver overall.
Yeah, we might get into this a little later, but I actually just skied in Europe for the first time a few weeks ago, and I was amazed at the energy efficient operations and how much effort they've put into trying to save energy. I would say in particularly where I'm at in the United States, we have some of the cheapest electricity in the country and probably the world. So it's not quite as much of a focus here. We certainly do what we can as far as turning off lights and things at night. But as far as day-to-day operation of lifts, we don't adjust lift speed based on energy or crowding. And we also don't close lifts when it's quiet. We run every lift every day with a very set schedule.
Yeah, well, that's certainly a good advert for Jackson. We will talk about that trip to Europe because I did notice that when I was doing my research. But let's come back to your website, Lift Blog. So obviously, you know, from a pretty young age, you'd skied quite a lot of areas. You know, you said you're going out every weekend when you're on the East Coast in New England. There's a lot of ski resorts in that area. You've been in the Rockies and you've been over on the West as well. When did your website liftblog.com start then, and why did he start it?
Well, I've always been interested in the lifts as much as I've been interested in skiing. I mean, as long as I can remember, I was sort of in my head cataloging the different lifts at each ski resort and what type of lift it was and how long it was and maybe how old it was. So I've always been sort of doing that in my head, and I started kind of keeping track on a computer when I was pretty young. But the website started as an off-season project when I was just a seasonal employee here in Jackson. I was just thinking of some way to share all the knowledge and information that I had collected about lifts and skiing with others. And I read a lot of other blogs about other topics, and I realized there was no website just about ski lifts. And it was created for about, I think it was $200 on WordPress.com. And that is the same website you see today. It's pretty simple, but it's gotten much larger.
Yeah. Well, there's a lot of information on there. What year was it that it went live?
2015.
Right. So relatively recently then. Okay. You know, I think one of the things that probably got you a lot of visitors to start off with, and something that you probably found quite interesting cataloging, was the lists of new lifts that were coming in the following season. And I had a little look at it earlier this week. I was looking at, okay, these are all of the lifts that are planned to go into operation for the 2023-24 season that have been announced already anyway. And they're, you know, you've obviously used Google Maps and plotted them on there, and you can, you know, cross-reference it through that. Those lists of new lifts that were one of the kind of driving forces behind the website?
Yes, that is a very popular part of my website. And I personally, because I'm so interested in all these lifts, I personally find it like I just really try and keep track of what's coming next. I'm always on the lookout for a press release about a new lift, or maybe even just like a permit application with the government for permission to build a new lift. I've gotten pretty good at sort of sleuthing around and figuring out how these projects become public record, always looking out for what's coming next. And right now in particular, it's a really exciting time in the United States because ski resorts are really expanding and building a lot of new lifts.
Right. Okay. I mean, we'll come on to Europe, but in Europe it is very different because I was trying to put together a blog post myself that I'm going to write for someone else about the number of valley lifts, projects that are going to go from the valley floor up to resorts. And there's lots of reasons for this. They want to take traffic off the road, etc. It's a sustainability driver behind it. But some of these projects have been, you know, talked about and underway for 5 to 10 years already. You were talking about sleuthing around and trying to find that you must have projects like that where it's rumored and it's always going to happen. It's always going to happen, but it keeps being pushed further into the future.
Absolutely. And then there are other ones that I've never heard a peep about and just catch me completely by surprise. It's amazing how far sometimes they can get along without becoming public. And then all of a sudden they're digging, there's holes in the ground and someone sends me a picture and says, this looks like a lift is going in here. And I have to say, oh, wow, I didn't know about that one.
And so the website itself, you know, details all of the lifts, but you know, you yourself, you mentioned earlier, you visited over 3,000 lifts. I don't know if have you been on all of those 3,000, or have you just seen them?
I've been to the top. Sometimes it's tricky, you know, you'll go to a ski resort and there'll be two lifts right next to each other, and one will be running and the next one won't. Or I go on a particular day and, you know, one lift off to the side is broken that day, or they don't have enough staff to run it. So I haven't ridden every single lift, but I have one way or another photographed each lift.
Well, evidently these other resorts don't have the same high standards that Jackson Hole have, which are always going to run all lifts. But what, you know, what came first then, this goal of seeing all of the lifts and photographing all the lifts? So was that after the website started, or was that already well underway by the time you started the website?
So I had started taking pictures of lifts where I went before the website started, but I never thought I would be able to go to all of them. I just kept working at it in chunks, you know, 4, 5, 6 ski resorts at a time on a trip. It wasn't clear until pretty close to the end that I actually could visit all of them, because there are some pretty remote places in the United States with ski lifts, in Alaska, in North Dakota, some places that are open 5 days a year, some places that are owned by a private school that, you know, only operate on Saturdays when it snows. So it wasn't clear until the very end that I could actually make this happen.
Right, but you have, and so to go to over 3,000 resorts, 3,000 lifts, 720 resorts, how do you actually find the time to be able to do it?
Well, one of the amazing things about my employer, one of the things I really appreciate here, is we are very committed to a 4-day work week. So everybody in mountain operations works 4 days a week. And it's shift work. So I have colleagues I can sometimes trade days with if I would need to go to, say, Virginia, which is way on the East Coast. I can get a couple days covered by a coworker and then work for him another time and string some days together and then fly where I need to go and not miss any work. Just use my weekend and then a few days of trades.
Well, I love that. That is flexible working. You mentioned, you know, that, I mean, obviously people know that North America is a continent of an extremely vast size. To fly across it, it will take hours in itself. And, you know, there are some lifts, some ski resorts that are in decidedly non-mountainous states. Because I was looking on the list there, I think, and Oklahoma, Wisconsin, Tennessee, do they have ski lifts?
Absolutely. Nearly every state has some form of ski lift, not always at a ski resort, but it really is remarkable, the United States ski industry. You know, listeners in Europe probably think of Vail and Mammoth and Big Sky, but there are hundreds of smaller, mid-sized mountains that really aren't even mountains all across the country. You know, the states with the most individual mountains are kind of surprising. It's New York State, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, Michigan. Those places have 20, 30, 40 ski areas apiece. And then you look at a state like Wyoming, where Jackson Hole is, and we really only have 10 or 15 ski areas here. So the ski industry in America is very diverse. There are mountains of all sizes and shapes. And I've enjoyed visiting all the different types.
Yeah, and you've been to all of them. And you mentioned Alaska just then. I mean, just like physically, that must be the hardest to get to and visit and get around. I mean, the infrastructure is not quite there that it is in some other states.
Yeah, it's varied. The skier areas near Anchorage are actually quite easy to get to. Anchorage is a pretty large city and has lots of flights in. So there are a cluster of ski areas right near Anchorage and Fairbanks that were fairly simple. And that's actually where I was when COVID March 2020 shut down. I was in Alaska and worried about how I was going to get home.
Yeah.
But then the other, like in Southeast Alaska, there are some towns with ski areas that are not accessible by any road. So you either have to fly there or take a boat. And I actually have a funny story. One of the last ones I visited was called Mount Eyak, E-Y-A-K, in Cordova, Alaska. And I had to take a flight that's called the Milk Run on Alaska Airlines. It starts in Seattle and it stops at like six different Southeast Alaska towns on its way to Anchorage every day. We stopped at a few other towns first, but when we got to Cordova, we stopped. There's no gates or anything, no terminal building. You just park on the tarmac and the plane stopped and nobody got up. And finally, after a few minutes, they got on the PA and they said, Mr. Landsman, we have one passenger for Cordova. Please exit now. And I was the only person going to that town that day.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think that probably sums up the dedication that you've put in to go and see all of these different resorts. And you mentioned, you know, Europe. I think looking through your Instagram, and I saw that you came over to Europe this year for the Interalpine Trade Fair, and that is the world's largest trade show for mountain technology. Happens in Austria or Innsbruck every couple of years. How was that experience? How was that for you?
It was an incredible trip. I had never been. I had been to Europe just to go to the tourist cities in London and Paris, but I had never been to the mountains. So I had heard about skiing in Europe forever. Never had the chance to do it, but I got to go, and it was in mid-April, and I'd heard about the snow situation. I was a little worried. You know, I thought maybe I just go to the trade show and don't ski, but pretty quickly I realized I've got to bring ski gear. And I got to go skiing. I got to go to the trade show and also some lift factories, which were really incredible.
Yeah. Where did you ski them?
I was directed by the lift companies where to go for the coolest lifts. So I went to Solden, Ischgl, Arlberg, and I did one day in Germany at the riding the tram up to the Zugspitze.
So, yeah, I can imagine. I'm visualizing some of the lifts that you went on. I think, you know, they have some great, I think you call them trams, maybe we call them cable cars. But the Galzig Barn in St. Anton, you said you went to Aalborg. Was it St. Anton that you skied?
Yep, the Galzig Barn was the first lift I rode there for sure.
Yeah, it's beautiful design at the bottom there.
I'd been seeing videos of that Ferris wheel type station since it was built, and that was a long time ago now, and I finally got to ride it, and it was incredible.
As you'll know probably better than me, there's so many other lifts that you can take the opportunity of. We'll come back to Europe another time. Now you've knocked out the 720 resorts in North America. You might have more trouble doing it over a weekend like you have done, you know, in the States so far. So you probably know more about lifts than anyone in the industry. I wanted to ask your opinions then. I don't know if this is like a quick fire round or whatever, but T-bars or button lifts? What's your opinion there?
Like, which one is better, or what do I think of them?
Which one's better, T-bars or button lifts?
I'm always by myself, usually on these trips, so might as well just be a button lift. We actually call them platter lifts here,
right?
Because it's kind of like a platter you would eat food off of. they're not very common though. You have many more of them in Europe than we have here in the States.
Okay, is that because you mainly have chairs? Or do you actually have T-bars?
We have some T-bars as well, but we call those both of those surface lifts, and they're not nearly as common. They are more common in Canada, but in the United States, most of these smaller ski resorts have just fixed grip chairlifts.
Yeah, well, okay, that leads me on to my next question then, because you know, one of the innovations we've seen in chairlifts more recently is detachable chairlifts versus fixed grip chairlifts. Got a view there?
They both have their place. I'm a sucker for a double chair that's old, but as a technology guy, I would have to say detachable lifts are very cool machines.
Yeah, I mean, a double chairlift. I don't think it's around anymore, but I have been on a single chairlift in the ski resort of Baquera Beret in Spain, in the Spanish Pyrenees, a long time ago. I think that's probably been replaced now. But a double chairlift is pretty rare. I'm not sure where I might have been on one in recent years. It's possible that in Roccarossa in Italy, I went on one. But okay, that leads me to my next question then. We already have 6-person chairs. There are 8-person chairs. Are they just going to get bigger and bigger? Are we ever going to see like a 10-person chair?
I don't think we'll go much bigger, but I do think 10-person is possible. There are a lot of very visionary ski resort operators out there who like to dream up crazy ideas. And if there's one thing I've learned with this, the lift manufacturers, if you dream it up and have enough money, they will build whatever kind of lift that a customer wants. So I will never say never on that one. I think it's possible.
Right. Okay. I mean, talking about like strange lifts, what's the strangest lift you've seen then?
You mentioned single chairs. This place I went in Cordova, Alaska, actually has a single chair that was built in the 1930s in Sun Valley and moved up to Alaska. It's partially made of wood. It's a single chair, which is very unique for the United States, and operates very, very sparingly when they have snow at sea level in Alaska. And then another one, as far as more modern lifts, in New Jersey, there's an indoor ski resort, the first in America, called Big Snow. And they have a quad chairlift that actually hangs from the ceiling instead of having towers coming up from the ground. So you're riding below most of the lift equipment, which is pretty unique.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Well, it sounds weird. I mean, you know, I have been to quite a lot of indoor snow centers. I can't remember that I've been on any that have a chairlift in there. What length is the slope there at Big Snow?
I would guess it's about 800 feet long. You'll know what that is in meters, but
yeah, roughly 300 meters, something like that, maybe 270, something like that. Yeah, that's quite a lengthy slope. Well, that's one to look out for. Okay, got another question for you. This is actually one that I saw that I think maybe you discussed somewhere else on your blog or something like this. We get on these lifts the whole time as skiers, and you know, we put all his faith into you know, these cables that are running above our heads. But the cables go round and round and round. But once upon a time, it was a single piece of cable. So how does that become a continuous loop? How do they get joined somewhere?
This is a very timely question, because 2 days ago, we did a splice, we call it, on the tram at Jackson, and I was actually on the crew that helped with that. So the short answer is each of those cables is made up of 6 to 8 strands that are woven together. So when a new lift is built, a strand gets unwoven one at a time and then woven into the other end. And then you take the second strand and weave it into the other end. And then you take the third strand and weave it into the other end. And typically there are six strands, three woven in each direction. And then the end of each strand is tucked into the core. So you cut out a section of the core of the rope, which is these days plastic, and tuck the end in. So there end up being 6 tucks. If you're really paying attention, you can actually see them as you're riding where the splice is. But the short of it is this process for splicing a rope that comes from Switzerland. It's been done for hundreds of years, probably thousands of years. The people who do it are very, very knowledgeable and skilled at it. And it works, even though it doesn't sound like it would work. The ropes hold. You don't hear about when there are accidents on lifts, it's things falling off of ropes and people falling off of lifts, but not the haul rope coming apart or anything like that.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, you know, occasionally something goes viral. It's normally, I seem to remember an awful one. I can't remember where it was now. Maybe Uzbekistan or one of the stands a few years ago where the lift went crazy and it wasn't stopping or slowing down to allow people to get off. But, you know, typically, you know, accidents are very rare. And I'm going to look out now for that splice and see if I can ever spot it in the cable.
If you're really a nerd like me, you can notice it based on not just the appearance of it, but also you can hear it when it passes a tower. The splice makes a little bit different noise than the lift makes normally. That incident you mentioned about the lift going in reverse was in the country of Georgia. It was Gadari Ski Resort, and that turned out to be quite a modern lift that was tinkered with by staff that had not been properly trained, and so basically it was human error.
Pretty awful one, as you say. The cables themselves, you know, are extremely good. You mentioned when you're over in Interalpen, you found it quite interesting seeing some of the innovations that the European resorts were doing and the European manufacturers. Was there anything that stood out to you there?
One second, I just got to show you a moose walk by.
Look at that. That's brilliant. If you go to Jackson Hole, that's what you get.
You were asking about Interalpen.
Yeah. Sorry. When you're at Interalpen, you mentioned some of the innovations there. Any innovations that stood out to you that particularly of interest?
Yeah. So all the lift manufacturers were there. In Europe, like we talked about, energy efficiency is a really big deal. These lifts they're starting to use AI technology to monitor automatically ridership and people in the queue, and slowing lifts down automatically, turning the seat heating off if it's too warm, things like that to maximize energy efficiency. And then another big one at the show that was exhibited was technology for making lifts unmanned. So you're already way ahead of us in Europe as far as not having so much staff requirement for running a chairlift or a gondola. But Doppelmayr in particular has a program where they're monitoring ropeway stations remotely, so they can have one person watching multiple lifts and multiple stations without physically being there watching what's going on at each station individually.
Yeah, I think an example of that is and I have to check my pronunciation, but it's in Zermatt, the Kumme lift in Zermatt, I'm trying to recall. Yeah, it is Doppelmayr, exactly. Because I remember blogging about it before and that it's saying it's an unmanned station there. Must be an example of one of the ones that you're talking about. So yep, yeah,
it's called Oro, the Doppelmayr version, and Leitner Palma, the big other manufacturer, has a version too. The Europeans are already way ahead on this. In the United States, we still have multiple lift operators at every station of every lift. You know, with the wages that we're paying now and the housing situation in some of these ski towns, the U.S. ski industry is starting to realize maybe it's not the smartest thing to need quite so much staff to run these lifts.
Yeah, although anecdotally, I can tell you that one of the things that people say when they do go skiing in America and Canada is that the customer service is incredible. So, you know, you kind of sort of pay your money and take your choice. But I guess it does seem inevitable that resorts are going to be a bit more efficient. And I fully understand that issue with, staffing accommodation. Certainly, we went to Sun Valley last summer and, you know, it's a big issue over there, finding affordable housing for people. I wondered if I could ask you then. So you've photographed, you've seen over 3,000 lifts in North America. You know, if you were talking to someone, you know, it doesn't matter where they are in the world, whether they're in North America or Europe, and you're going to say, right, okay, I'm going to pick out a few lifts. Let's say, forget about the geographical limitations. If you go to any, you know, two or three or four lifts in the States, which ones would you be recommending that people go and have a look at?
I always say my favorite lift I've been on, at least in North America, is Peak to Peak at Whistler Blackcomb. Whistler Blackcomb is an amazing ski resort to begin with, even before they had the Peak to Peak. They have two incredible mountains that are just enormous. But then they connected them with this gondola that goes straight across mid-mountain of each. And the highest point, you're something like 1,800 feet in the air. It's a 3S gondola, which is a kind of a cross between a cable car and a regular gondola. So it's got really cool lift technology with detachable grips running over multiple cables. And it's in a beautiful place. So Peak to Peak would be my number one. And then my number two would probably be Big Sky Montana. They have a number of really cool lifts. The top lift there is the Lone Peak Tram, which goes up to 11,144 feet. It's actually currently being replaced with a larger aerial tram. So I'll need to go back there to go on that new tram. But Big Sky is really high alpine terrain above tree line with some really modern lifts. So that would be my number two must go for lift enthusiasts.
Cool. Okay. Well, I'll add those to, you know, what happens when I interview people, you know, for this podcast is I just get more and more things to add to my bucket list of places to ski and things to see. But, you know, that has been a really, really interesting conversation. And I am absolutely sure that our listeners will enjoy it as well. When we go skiing, one thing that is the same between everybody, unless you're on, you know, a backcountry ski touring trip, is that we all take lifts. And so much of the time you kind of take them for granted and you think, oh, you know, there's a fast four man here and there's this here and there's that there, etc. But just thinking a little bit more about them, you know, I find really interesting. So I really appreciate your time, Peter, and you getting up early in the morning for us, and wish you all the best for the summer season in Jackson Hole. And, you know, keeping on top of whatever new lifts there are and your travels for next winter. And hopefully we'll see you over here in Europe again, because evidently there's thousands more lifts that you can try at some point.
Yeah, there are about 60, just over 60 new lifts going in the United States and Canada this summer. And my goal will be to hit all of them next winter. So I'm going to rest up this summer and then get after it. And Europe, I think when I go to Europe, just like this last trip, it will be for vacation. And instead of cataloging every lift in great detail, I'll just ski and enjoy myself and enjoy Europe.
Cool. Well, that's brilliant, Peter. And listener, I'll put all the links in the show notes, but you can have a look at liftblogger.com, and I'll put a link to Peter's Instagram in there as well. That's great, Peter. Thanks very much. Have a great day.
Thanks for having me, Ian.
Well, I hope you enjoyed my chat with Peter. You can always let me know. I enjoy all feedback about the show. You can contact us via social at The Ski Podcast or by email, theskipodcast@gmail.com. We now have 99 reviews on Apple Podcasts. I'd like to thank Henry J for his recent 5-star review, and he said definitely worth a listen. If you want to be the 100th, that would be amazing. And by the way, apologies if you are a user outside of the UK. I've only recently discovered that for some reason Apple doesn't let me see your reviews. So that's great if you have given us a review, but please do email me as well with your thoughts. Now, there are now 181 episodes of the Ski Podcast to catch up with, and 142 were listened to in the last week. So don't forget to subscribe so you don't miss an episode. And if you do enjoy the podcast, you can always buy me a coffee at buymeacoffee.com/theskipodcast. Now, you can follow me at Skipedia and the podcast at The Ski Podcast. I would like to thank Le Travelet for sponsoring the show, and thank my guest today, Peter Landsman from liftblog.com. And finally, listener, thank you for joining us. And until next time, goodbye. Thanks for listening to this episode of The Ski Podcast. Don't forget that if you want to support the podcast, then remember to book your ski hire with Intersport and use the code SKIPODCAST, or simply take the link in the show notes. It'll save you money and help us too. Thanks again, and have a great winter.